Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we are joined by Dane Hillard, the author of Practices of the Python Pro, a regular DjangoCon speaker. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
No, thank you for coming there.
So there's a lot of things we're going to talk about. We'll get to the book. But before that, I've seen you in person give two talks, and maybe you could mention how you got into the Python Django world. So what's your origin story?
Yeah, I think I came out of school doing a lot of C and C++ programming and things like that. And sometime into that, a friend of mine asked me to join him at a hackathon. And it was a Ruby thing that he was working on. I think we were trying to develop some arbitrary precision number library. And
something superficial like that. Yeah.
I guess it kind of revealed to me what some more modern and interesting languages look like.
You don't like Corvettes. Like C's a Corvette.
So you didn't do Python with your undergrad programming at all?
No, not at all.
Was it just the C stuff and Java, I'd assume?
Yeah, we didn't even do any Java in my program.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it was all C++ and MATLAB.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so, that's a computer science degree?
Yep. Computer engineering, I guess. So kind of a mix of hardware in there too, but all kind of focused on embedded applications and things.
But you got through it, so now everything is just downhill from there.
In some ways, I don't know. I've sort of foregone the hardware aspect of things in my career, which I'm okay with. So I guess after this kind of like realization that maybe there are some fun languages to work with, I started using Python at one of my jobs. It must have been my last job, early on in my last job. And we were doing bioinformatics work. So data science applications obviously are one thing Python is good at. And around the same time, I guess I was looking for something to rewrite a personal website in for my photography. And I wanted to do something that would help me learn something new rather than just using, you know, WordPress or something like that. I heard about this thing called Django.
And what year was this? Do you recall sort of circa?
It must have been around 2014, I would say.
So that was what, like 1.5?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
So you had all the difficult migrations.
That's a good time to get in.
Well, either that or it's just slightly too early. Yeah, right?
1.8 was migrations.
Yeah, I did. Right? That was I did get in before migrations were part of the standard deal, if you will. Since then I've picked it up for more things, and then kind of got into my current job by way of Django. At the time they were migrating off of kind of a legacy CMS, if you will, and working toward more continuous integration and custom infrastructure on AWS. And a lot of that kind of stuff. And a major part of the sort of front end of the website that we build, they had started doing in Django. So
now this is Ithaca, right? Is the name of the company?
That's right.
And they run, there's a couple like well-known services that they are in charge of. Like what's the business aspect of that?
Yeah, so jstor.org is probably the one that most people know.
Right.
And that's an academic journal archive. And there's also Art Store that we merged with a couple of years ago, kind of the same concept for art history studies. And then they have a couple of other business areas, all kind of in higher education.
Got it. Well, and I like that you said Django is part of the front end, because that's a point Carlton and I have hit on in this podcast, is that Django actually sort of is a front end framework. But maybe you could put that in the context. What does the full stack look like, where you can say that Django's the front end part?
Yeah, it's a great point to draw on. I think that Django, for me, sits very much at the area of concerns on most of my projects, I should say. where you're interested in responding to requests directly from users often. And to me, that makes it sort of part of the front end. At Ithaca, that's especially emphasized because really once a request makes it to Django, we then talk to a variety of further backend services, typically written in Java, in order to get authentication and metadata about content and all this stuff. And Django acts kind of as a glue to all of that, with a specific application toward the JSTOR web front end, right?
Yeah.
So are you using the Django ORM? How does that glue together?
We aren't for a lot of the sort of mission critical parts. Those are all dealt with in the backend services. So we use the ORM for some sort of internal back office type things. But we're really just using mainly the request handling portion of Django and the middleware aspects of Django, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, still gives you access to the middleware, which is sort of the kind of what Django is besides the ORM.
Right. We have integrated kind of the authentication backend with Django's authentication system as well.
Do you use remote user or that kind of thing?
I don't know if we're using the remote users. We maybe should.
Well, you'd be set up for that potentially, or, you know, token GWT.
Yeah, we do. We have like a custom user model and a custom authentication backend written that integrates with that service.
Right, okay.
So a nerdy question, if you recall, are you using abstract base user or just abstract user? Like how much are you getting into it?
It's been a while since I
don't expect
at
you
this
to know
code,
unless yeah. You, yeah, you wouldn't have written it yourself. But you know, for listeners, so you the sort of quick way is to use abstract user, which brings in abstract base user. But if you want to go way down under, you can use abstract base user, which the further I use Django, the more I'm like, I'll just use abstract base user. But when I teach it, I just do abstract user because it's a lot simpler and you don't have to worry about screwing up as much. But the eventual code is arguably cleaner, assuming you understand. But then I don't know, what do you think, Carlton? Then you're sort of rewriting Django,
yeah,
but it...
Like, why are you rewriting Django? Like, I don't know. You know my view. I want a manual transmission,
Carlton.
I just use the bog standard. Ah, you want a manual, fine. Okay, yeah.
Well, you use profiles. You don't even use
I use the built-in user model, and I'm just like, yeah, whatever. If I need extra fields, I'll just use a one-to-one, you know.
Well, I mean, because, you know, to get into it, so Django Auloth, do you know if you're using that,
Dave? We're not using that. I'm familiar with the library, okay. Though.
Right. Yeah. So that's very popular. And you can use that to have email only. But behind the scenes, it's still using username for admin. And it's sort of like adding 2-digit numbers onto username. So, you know, that's a problem you want to have when you kind of blow through all the, you know, will-999, all those iterations. But part of the purist in me goes, well, I don't like that. I want to do it all myself. So anyways, as an aside, this is the problem, Carlton. The more I program, the more I become one of those people. I'm like, I'll just do it all.
No, but
scratch.
This is where you end up, right? You're like, oh, I'm just going to knock up a website. And then you start building a website builder. And then you start, you know, it just goes on and on.
Then I start, then it's like I'm fighting Django. It's like, why even use Django? And, you know, just, yeah. Sorry. Authentication, though.
So I guess where I was, we were talking about sort of the pieces of Django that we use. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we also take advantage of.
What's the front end? Are you using a JavaScript library or using the server templates?
It's kind of a mix at the moment. We definitely use the templating engine from Django. So I guess that's another major aspect that we definitely leverage, right? And then we also are starting to use some more front end frameworks. Vue and React have made their way onto the site in some areas.
Both of them.
Yeah, both of them. We also have plenty of legacy code in jQuery, right? So,
oh, it depends which freelancer's in this week, right?
Yeah. We're also kind of building a design system at the moment, and I'm actually on the team that is working on that. So we're trying to figure out how we can build web components that will be supported, you know, in a variety of these frameworks. web components proper, like the standard that's being worked toward.
Right. Seems like something worth working towards.
Yeah. I think we need it.
And now I'll link to it. You gave a talk at, I think, PyOhio on PyTest. I wanted to ask about testing, and I assume, you know, if it's a large site, you're probably using PyTest, unit tests. Like, what does the testing situation look like?
Yeah, we are using PyTest. We kind of moved to PyTest maybe within the last year for sure. I'm trying to remember how long ago it was exactly, but I would highly recommend it to...
That must feel good internally to switch over, right? Yeah. Like, that's hard to explain to a business person, but something like that is like deeply meaningful.
Yeah, I would say that PyTest has really boosted our testing productivity for sure. We're also maintaining kind of a variety of packages that are installed in our various applications. And so between PyTest and Tox, I think we've really seen a lot of productivity. We're trying to, I guess Tox helps us test across sort of current and next version of both Django and Python. And it's helped us make sure that we're forward facing.
Yeah, it's really good as well because, you know, you're on 3.6 and you want to upgrade for 3.7, you don't know if you can. Well, you can build a Tox environment, run your test suite. When that's passing, you can upgrade. It's, you know, and then you can get 3.8 in, and it's just, it's a really nice way of
testing. Can you publicly say which version of Django you're on?
I think I can say that. We just migrated to 2.2.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, ahead of the 1.11 end of life as well. So I was happy about that.
on this podcast, we're a bit strict on, you know, you should always update like your car. But for a large enterprise site to be on 2.2 is, that's really good. That's not common.
Yeah. I will say that I think the process of going from 1.11 to 2.2 was actually much easier than going from like 1.8 to 1.11. In our experience.
Yeah, no, but that's just objectively the case. Like, updating Django now is incredibly easy, incredibly stable versus, you know, before there was more breaking changes and, you know, it's a much more mature framework now than it was.
Yeah. We were able to sort of fully get to 2.2 compatibility without actually making the upgrade. I remember maybe putting in two conditions, I think, sort of, you know, if Django 2.2 or higher, do this. Yeah. Only in two or three places that I can think of, and the rest just sort of like worked in both versions. Yeah. So that was really enjoyable, actually.
That's great. Well, that's a testament to the community and the fellows, you know.
Carlton, yeah, no, well, look, work. Tim, again, it's Tim. Like Tim Graham did so much work to get Django on this stable footing that it's on. I mean, so, you know, again, to go Tim.
And yeah, like I said, PyTest and Tox really helped us through that, I think, because we were able to just run our full suite of tests in both situations. And, you know, now that we're on 2.2, we've updated our testing environment to include 3.0 for when that comes, right? Fortunately, now we're on
3.1.
3.1. Fortunately, we're on 2.2, which will be a long-term support for some 2022, is it?
Yeah, it's another 2 years. It's another 2 years from now. So, like, you could... But, like, if you've got that Tox environment in place, there's no reason why you couldn't do the little hop step all the way, you know, 3.3.1 when that comes, and then 9 months' time you're on 3.2, that, you know, as soon as it's out the door.
Yep.
So what does this CI/CD look like for running all these tests?
We use Jenkins for most everything.
Yeah.
That's what I mean.
I think that's by far the most common still at large sites.
It's certainly the sort of de facto standard if you can't put it out in something like Travis or Circle CI or something, right? And it's free, which has its ups and downs.
Free.
Yeah.
Just developer time.
Yeah. So it, you know, we have experienced, I think, some growing pains on it. They do have this Jenkins file approach now. You can write sort of declarative and procedural stuff in Groovy. And that has been helpful because it's much easier to kind of define what you want rather than fiddling around with their UI menus. So we're doing, we have sort of a Kubernetes cluster that can spin up Jenkins instances and run jobs as we see fit, which is pretty fantastic. But sort of managing all of the resourcing and pooling of workers and nodes and things has been somewhat troublesome. We're kind of at a steady state now.
Yeah, it's difficult.
So you said Kubernetes, so you're using Docker then locally?
Not for local development so much. I think we want to get there. But our apps are containerizable.
Right, so, clearly. Yeah.
I think there's mostly kind of efficiency things to work out before it would be too helpful in local development. We still haven't made our images small enough to iterate quickly on.
Well, we just recently had Katie McLaughlin on from Google, and we were discussing Alpine versus Slim versus Full, and she brought up the point, which I wasn't aware of, that Alpine is just a completely different world, actually, because, of course, Slim has the Psycho PG too, but and optimizing your containers is incredibly important.
Yeah.
I'm not very good at it. I mean, but I know it becomes a big issue fast when it's, 700 megabytes for Python and on you go.
Yeah.
It's gigabytes locally.
Another big issue we've faced trying to use Alpine is that it has its own C compiler.
That was the point that she was making. Yeah.
So we had a couple of libraries specifically that have no wheel available for Alpine. I don't think Alpine even does wheels, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure. But in any event, we had to incur the cost of building like libxml or lxml from scratch.
Yes. That's one of the ones that, I mean, so personally, I just default to Slim these days because it's like, maybe I could use Alpine, but it's,
There's
then I have to poke under the covers too much.
Yeah. There's like this trade-off between how many batteries you have included and how bloated your image ends up being. So
So we come to Python. Let's talk about your book. So you have this fantastic book. I've read it. How did that come about? Like, what's the and I'm curious too, just as a fellow book author, like, why would you spend the time to write a book? Like, are you crazy? Why would you do that?
So I'm not sure how much this is the case for everyone. In my particular case, sort of the publisher that I wrote this book with has someone on staff who reaches out to people doing online blogging and things like that to see if they're interested.
This is Manning, right?
So someone reached out to me and said, "Hey, we've seen some of your writing online. Have you ever considered writing a book?" And I was like, "Well, no, I've never have thought of that." And I guess I thought about it for a bit, and it spoke to, I think, a lot of the goals I had with writing online in the first place. I like sharing knowledge. I like, starting conversations. So by putting things out there, you give others a chance to say, "Well, I handled this problem this way. You said you approach it this way, but I have this other solution as well." So opening up those kinds of conversations is really interesting to me. And so in general, I like just putting things out there and seeing, if I can help someone or if I can pull information out of other people by way of those conversations, right? So, I figured writing a book could be another sort of natural way to go about that. And then from there, they have you kind of propose a whole, like, not just the table of contents or what the book might contain, but sort of a timeline of how you think you can get that done. Which is generally
how accurate was that?
Right?
You're a software engineer. How on earth are you going to come up with
Right. So I doubled
my life for a living, right?
Added another 50% or whatever.
6 to 8 months.
I think my original proposal was probably something like a year. And I was over that, but not by a heck of a lot as far as things go in the long term, maybe a year and 3 months or something, right? So a lot of that time is really spent with your development editor, going through making sure that you are teaching to the audience that you identified up front, as well as then each chapter sort of goes through a technical editing phase. They check your code, make sure that it runs, make sure that it does what you said it does. And then at the end, they also do all of the typical kind of copy editing, language editing. And then throughout your sort of writing, writing these examples, they have someone do a final check on all those. You're creating figures for the book, so they have people kind of redo those and make them look nice and polished.
So you just ended a napkin.
You just described like months and months of my time that I had to do on top of everything else because I'm I self-publish.
Yeah.
So that's why I typically advise people to go through a publisher if they just want to have a book out, because it's a lot of work and most people have no idea all the things involved in a book if they haven't done one before.
Yeah. The time is one thing, your estimate versus how long it takes, but seeing all those things that really go into it on the publisher's end was pretty fascinating to me.
You describe your audience. You said they do a review to make sure you're targeting the audience. And the audience for the book is what I think of as advanced beginner, right? So they know how to program. They've done their first, few projects. Capable. But then it's how do you move beyond that to a more sort of high level? Go on, carry on.
That's exactly right. I think the book is intended to help folks who are starting to move into those larger projects that may last, a year, many years, so that they can sort of build in maintainability and long-term kind of understanding and the ability to collaborate on that code base with others.
So, the big thing in there, the big thing that really jumped out was your focus on encapsulation and breaking things down and keeping the implementation hidden from the outside so that you can reason about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the two-part, both that you pose the questions that professional developers do think about that if you haven't had that experience, it wouldn't even occur to you. And then you walk through the various, examples. So I think even just the first part, just to sort of know the playing field of choices that you're going to face in a large project is incredibly helpful to people.
Thank you. I think a lot of times, a lot of these things come down to exposure, right? A lot of times as a developer, anyone at any stage in their career, right? There's often just things you don't know that you don't know. So it all comes down to exposure.
After about 5 years, you've got it all figured out.
Yeah. You got to figure it out. You know nothing.
Yeah.
So the goal with the book was kind of like, here are some things I've found myself thinking about and trying to solve. As someone a few years earlier in your career, if you start thinking about those now, you'll be in really good shape.
Yes. So I have to ask, so people come to you, you have a Python book. What advice do you give on installing Python? Because there's a lot of options and I don't see any. What do you tell people when they say, should I use pip? Should I use poetry? Should I use pipenv? Should I use, pyenv? How do you answer that question?
That's a tough, it's a really tough one.
I mean, it's nice to just say, of course it's installed and works perfectly on your Mac, Windows, Linux, Chromebook.
This is Appendix A, right?
Yeah.
Or Docker. That's what I did in my most recent book. I was like, we're just going to Docker everything, so don't worry about it.
Yeah.
It's like, what's Docker? Just download this, copy this file, and pray that it works.
Yeah. I have an appendix in the book that talks about it. I'm not sure that it's as comprehensive as maybe I'd like. If I were talking to someone face-to-face, I think I would go into more detail in some areas or suggest maybe a slightly different approach. And I think the best approach to me is one where you build off of the basics and really understand what's going on behind the scenes a bit. Things like poetry and pipenv especially are, they're fantastic in their own right, but they also do abstract a ton of things away from you. And if and when they break, which some of them often do, It's kind of hard to know how to correct course if you didn't do those underlying things yourself before, right? So a really good understanding of PIP and dependency resolution in general would be a good thing to do before sort of just letting Poetry or pipenv do all the work for you, right?
But I think you've got to know what VMV is and how it works. And as you know, we always have this.
I think that's the big one. Because like JavaScript, you don't have that, right? For example, Greg's, a lot of people, JavaScript's the first one. And then they hit Python, they're like, that it doesn't make sense to them why they need virtual environments.
And it's difficult for beginners. I appreciate there is a learning curve to VMV, but you've got to have that.
Yeah. I mean, so I have this installpython3.com site because I've written about this and that's open source, because I'm trying to sort of tackle this issue. But what I find is that the problem is that beginners have already mucked up their local computer by the time they get to the right answer.
Yeah.
Right.
They've gone to python.org. They've downloaded a couple tars or whatever it is. They've messed up their path, you know, so they've half downloaded three things. And then when they go on their command line to type Python, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. And so even if, like on a Mac, for example, I recommend Homebrew because I like using Homebrew, but their path is already messed up. Mm-hmm. And to explain to a beginner what path is, like, I can't. I do tell people sometimes, like, if you can just get an external hard drive, wipe everything truly, and then start from there. But that's a bad place to be in the community.
Yeah.
But that is the reality. Like, if you ask a normal person face to face to do Python, they're going to struggle.
Yeah. Something that, so I wrote an article as well on Real Python about Python environments and shell environments in general. So it kind of walks through what is a shell, what is a terminal, what are Python virtual environments, what are tools that manage Python virtual environments.
Okay, we'll link to that.
You mentioned Real Python. It's like, you know, that's been on my radar for a little while, but recently it's just been blowing it out of the water. It's just super. It's just so much good content on Real Python at the moment. I really recommend it to whoever.
It's like, it's like a super friendly group of people too. I'm in the Slack channel, and they're just constantly like adding new people too, and everyone's, you know, welcoming each other. And if you're thinking about writing and want sort of a channel other than your own to write on, I would definitely look into joining that group because they're great.
Yeah, Dan's done a lot of work there. I mean, because he took it over from my friend Michael Herman, and I think only 2 years ago. And it's amazing that he's able to the crew is able to maintain the standard quality, because it's quite a lot of work to have contributors and to have a consistent level of quality. But they've been pulling in some of the people I've seen individually writing fantastic stuff. And they've been doing a great job.
But not short pieces as well, like really extended, you know, in-depth wells of type things. Anyway, Real Python.
We're talking about the book editorial process. I think one reason that they're so strong is that they also have a very robust editorial process. So every article, it's not like you just write it and then it goes up.
Real Python, you're saying.
You know, there's a lot that goes into quality content people can actually learn from. So
how do they handle updates? That's always my question. I mean, there's no easy answer Python stuff is a little bit easier, but web framework stuff, because in 2 years, you know, Python 3, whatever, is going to be out. I wonder how they handle that, because that's for me, if I think of like, well, maybe I want to run a Django magazine, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Like, that's the one that really trips me up.
I mean, they encourage people who are writing articles to go back and update them. They also, you know, anyone on the team who notices an article could use updating is welcome to voice it and maybe make the update if, you know, whoever wrote it isn't around or needs help with it. Stale content is one of the most frustrating things as a developer today, I would say.
Well, and it's frustrating as a creator, because in 6 months it's stale and you're like, oh, geez, like, you know,
yeah.
I'm just speaking, you know, hypothetically.
Never happened before.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I said this before, but I mean, so for me, I have this learnjango.com site and I'm building some stuff out, but I envision only something like 50 maximum tutorials because I would like to keep them up to date, which means at least every 9 months. And so, it's a limiting factor, but at the same time, I don't want to read something that's old. Mm-hmm. I think the challenging thing is that if you're a professional, you can kind of, 90-95% of it is helpful and you can fill in the gaps. But if you're not at that level, you will get stuck on maybe a minor implementation thing, but you've lost the entire thread.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of that's the reality of it.
When you talked about sort of people doing a lot to screw up their machine before arriving at the right answer. And I think
yes.
Stale content on the web contributes to that too, because, for instance, a lot of people don't even know that Vienv exists in Python 3 standard library now, right?
I think it's 3.3.5 they added it, I think.
And it's, they're finding content that's like, first, easy install virtual and wrapper.
I have an older post that talks about using that and...
Easy install, yeah, so good.
It's a hard...
So good.
Yeah, easy install, setup tools, isn't that the other one? There's a couple out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's gotten better, but it's still, if I put my hat on, I would say the two things that hold Python back are the packaging and then in terms of like, how do you share Python and then just installing it.
Mm-hmm. When you have the Anaconda community and things like that too.
What is up with that? Because I recommend using like Miniconda for the Chromebook. I have a section on that because in that case, a Chromebook, the more recent versions, you can... go and use the Linux. And I've found that using Conda there is by far the easiest. But I do see, I mean, for example, the Django Crash Course, a new book by the Daniel and Audrey Greenfeld, who did Two Scoops of Django, mm-hmm. they recommend Anaconda from the beginning.
Interesting.
That's the word I would use too. So we're going to have him on so he can talk about it. I guess it makes sense in a data science realm to me, but if... It seems, I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, I did a little bit of research for that article I mentioned about environments because I had never really tried Anaconda, Conda, Miniconda, any of that stuff.
All the flavors, yeah.
And, it does provide a lot of the same things we're used to around virtual environments, if you will, and package management. And I guess another value add that it has, right, is that you can install non-Python things with the same package management system. It is
well, and then
interesting.
Well, and then there's, many students get a free PyCharm license, and PyCharm abstracts away the virtual environment. Mm-hmm. Basically, you do it within there. So I've seen students who didn't even really know what a virtual environment was because it was all handled within PyCharm. Mm-hmm. So they were going through my book and they're like, well, yeah, we just skipped the virtual environment part. And I was like, how'd that work out? They're like, oh, we're in PyCharm. And I, asked a couple follow-up questions and was just like, it's PyCharm. Plenty of professionals use PyCharm as well. Mm-hmm. But that was interesting to me because it's that trade-off. It's like, I don't want people to get stuck on installing it and these details, but I also don't want it to just be broken and not work.
Yeah.
So.
It's the double-edged sword, I guess, right? Like I was saying earlier, it's often helpful to build from the ground up so you understand the foundations. But at the same time, the reason we encapsulate and abstract things is so that you can start at a high level and then eventually work your way down to the details. So
if you need to.
It's hard to know which way to go.
Yeah, well, but if you think about, again, just thinking of JavaScript, it's Babel, where you can use any version of JavaScript. And I know there's been versions sort of like that with Python, though I don't think they're widely used, where you just could use everything from 3.8 down. Mm-hmm. That would be nice. Certainly in JavaScript, that was a huge, I think I'm saying this correctly, I think Babel is the name of the package, because mm-hmm. there was that big switch in JavaScript where they like waited 10 years and then nothing happened. And, and now it's all kind of like handled in the browser for you, which is also nice.
Mm-hmm. So just out of interest.
But again, Python,
do you call it the Tower of Babel?
Babel, right. Babel. I say Babel.
I say Babel as
right,
well.
Okay, interesting.
Is that the American version, Carlton?
Because Babel, I'm Babel? A British person, Babel would have two B's in the middle, right? Because it would be the Tower of Babel. But anyway, no, it's just because there's one of those cultural differences.
You've got to flatten
it out. That's fine.
That's cool. yeah, so Babel is like this transpilation approach that lets you can sort of target whichever browsers you need to support for your website, and it will produce something that's as compatible as possible with that set of things.
Well, I mean, it's specifically with Python. I don't know. I find it's the F strings. So 3-6, that's kind of where, cause I use them in my books and I do say I use Python 3.7. Mm-hmm. But you know, beginner, right? Like 9 times out of 10, the tell that they're on an old version is that the F strings. But, and again, you know, strings, I mean, if we're going to pick on Python, there's 4 different ways to do strings in Python, I think, these days. I mean, well, you're the Python pro. Which one do you like? I like F strings, but
you're talking
that's also
like
maybe
string templating specifically, right?
Well, yeah, we could get, yeah, sure.
So there's like percent formatting and dot format and all that. I was a big proponent of using dot format. I think it seems more readable to me.
I think so. Then the parenthesis, was it the, yeah, parentheses at the end, whatever that's called.
I guess using percent formatting, you can maybe find more errors. You know, it lets you specify what data type things should be, which can be helpful. Whereas format will work as long as you can turn whatever object it is into a string. and then, I mean, nowadays I definitely use F strings as much as I can, but.
But the thing, just going back to your point about 3.5 quickly before we move on, it's like, especially when you're looking at beginners, you've got to imagine someone picking up, you know, a computer that's any old computer. It could be 5 years old and it's got whatever version of Python it's got on it. And it's just so good if what they type just works, mm-hmm. right? And if as soon as we start accelerating the support matrix, so we start saying, well, you know, 3.5 is still, you know, it's still got another year or so to run before it's end of life, but we're going to drop support early. Then we're cutting out those. And obviously we can't support 3.4, 3.3, 3.2 forever and ever and ever. We've got to cut off somewhere. But I don't want to see us leave those people who are picking up a computer that's a few years old and it's just got Python. They just need it to work because if mm-hmm. they hit an error, the chance of them getting over it are like really low.
Yeah, it increases the friction, right?
Yeah.
I think that's where that bootstrapping, if you will, that Will's talking about could really start to be helpful if we found a good solution for that.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the other parts of the book. It is a book-length treatment. What are some of the feedback you've gotten from readers about the book? Because you cover a lot.
I do.
What are people saying? Oh, I didn't realize that. Or maybe what's the feedback like?
So I guess recently I asked a question on Twitter about sort of which chapters were most helpful to people.
I saw that.
Yeah. I have like a chance to make a free, you know, I select a couple of chapters from my book, a couple of chapters from other books that kind of have a common theme. So I asked people what the most helpful chapters for them were. And a couple of different people said the chapters about separation of concerns and flexibility and extensibility were kind of what resonated with them. So earlier in the book, there's a chapter about separation of concerns. And then later on, there's this chapter about putting that stuff into practice. So I think the reason I see that, maybe why people are saying that one was helpful, the one about putting it into practice, was because a lot of these concepts, especially if you haven't been exposed to them before, can feel very abstract, and it's easy to just kind of pontificate about them and say that they're good things to do. But it takes a different kind of learning to actually apply those things and to see examples that actually do that in a useful way that you might do that in a real code base.
To what extent do you think that it's useful to just read something like this before you even know, and then, you know, 6 months later, 12 months later, 18 months later, you're doing a bit of code, you think, oh, I could apply that, you know, that idea from Dane's book?
I guess while I was writing this book, as I introduced to this concept, I forget the name that it goes by, but the concept is essentially this idea that learning happens in a spiral. And so, you know, each axis of the spiral is a different concept that you're learning, and you start in the center of the spiral, or maybe on the outside of the spiral, and you work your way in. And so each time you reach that axis, you're like relearning something about that concept, but at sort of a different fidelity, right?
Yeah.
And I think that is a really useful way to learn. So the idea is to first introduce the concept and then start to show some examples and then give someone like a project that actually, they sort of need to do that thing. And I think that's what leads people to use the thing when they need it rather than look for a nail for their hammer, right?
Which works as well, right? You know.
But copy paste from Stack Overflow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's I tried to kind of shy away from design patterns too strongly in the book, because I think when you learn just this library of things at your disposal without necessarily seeing how they can be used in practice, you tend to try and apply them to every single thing you work on, right? And that's you end up with kind of a mess. So.
But one thing that I liked about the original design patterns thing, and like the book that inspired it by somebody, Alexander, whose first name I can't remember, but the idea of the design patterns, they create a pattern language, which then enables communication. So I can say to you, oh, we're going to use the decorator pattern here, and you'll know exactly what I mean. And, you know, we're able to fluently communicate about the domain in a way we weren't.
Mm-hmm. That's an astute observation, I think. I think shared vocabulary is one of the most important parts in a lot of this. And I was talking about a design system earlier that we're building at Ithaca, and that part of its value is exactly that same thing, just applied to sort of visual interfaces, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about a button, and then you're talking about a buy button, and you're talking about specific buttons, and everyone knows in their head the same button that you're referring to, right?
But,
that kind of thing is really important, especially with software engineers who are sort of, you know, stereotypically poor communicators or grumpy people. It's really nice to externalize a lot of that thought and make sure that everyone's on the same page.
Yeah. I would also add programmers are often not good typists, or they make a lot of mistakes, which when I started off as a book editor before I got into programming. So I sort of assumed that programming, you know, the code has to be perfect. So they're just going to be flawless typers, right? And then I didn't know about, linters and all these things. And then in practice, I see it's like they're even worse than authors, because some authors have terrible grammar, but programmers have just atrocious grammar, broadly speaking. But it's just self-corrected for them, so it comes out looking pixel perfect.
That's why we obsess about the tools.
Well, but it's like I say it's basically like Microsoft Word plus Grammarly on steroids, and everyone uses it as a default.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways,
yeah.
Aside for beginners, it's not true. There's lots of things programmers don't know how to do, including video conferencing. Carlton, I mess it up every time. So everyone's on Zoom right now. It's like how many Django professionals does it take to do video conferencing?
I'm thinking back to like, we just installed Pylint and Black into a lot of our shared packages.
Okay, so I know what Black is. What's Pylint?
Pylint is, it does a lot of things. It checks a number of PEP 8 things for you, I think.
But it's like Flake 8 on steroids, or?
I think it might include Flake 8 directly. I can't recall for sure, but, it also finds some things that Flake 8 won't catch. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but it finds common things that might be, dangerous down the road, whether it's, mutable default arguments or something like that. Maybe Flake 8 catches those too. I don't remember, but so it's a kind of code safety and code quality tool. It tries to be objective. Certainly some measures are always going to be subjective, but
so if someone walks up to you and says, oh, you wrote a book on Python prose, does anyone ever say, what's the short list of what I need to know? or how would you answer that? I mean, obviously, it'd be nice to say, you know, look at the book I wrote on it, right? It's like people ask me questions. I'm like, I already answered this somewhere. I don't know where. Like, you go look it up. But it's nice to have a bullet list response.
Yeah.
Like, what are the sort of, I mean, we mentioned sort of separation of concerns. Like, how do you prioritize that stack of beyond beginner Python knowledge?
It's a great question. I haven't received it directly. So I'm thinking a little bit about what that list really would be. But a lot of what I've been learning lately is because of sort of shared package management that I've been doing. And a lot of it comes down to the various aspects of the package management lifecycle, which are testing and formatting, consistent formatting for people to have an expectation of what the code's going to look like wherever they jump in. I guess I wouldn't necessarily tell just anyone off the street, right, to know all the things from my book, because a lot of those really are meant for someone who's advanced on to these larger projects. But separation of concerns, I think, is something anyone can benefit from. And then testing, I think, is pretty important to get into early on. I don't have that, like, I feel like I need maybe like 5 or 6 points on that, that list, not coming to my head readily, but.
Okay. That's quite a few things already though.
Well, I like that you mentioned the aesthetic aspect, because to make another JavaScript analogy, I mean, I recall, so JavaScript whitespace doesn't matter. So before this package named Prettier came out a couple years ago, it was just a nightmare. Everything looked different. You know, Python, at least whitespace does matter. It's easier to, I check, look at something and say, that seems okay. I mean, like one tell I have is like, if your function or your functions are super long, I sort of knock some points in my head. I don't know about you, Carlton. What do you think?
Like if I see an if, I'm like, oh, I'm sure we can put that somewhere. And if there's an for, I'm like, yeah, I'm sure that's a subroutine. And, you know, like, but like the thing is, though, you don't want to.
Where's the generator?
Right, but you don't want to break things. Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. You don't want to break things up too much, right? Because then you've got to go looking for the implementations. Whereas if it's you know, only 100 lines, it's easier to read it in one single function than it is to break it up into subroutines and. Do you see where I'm coming from? Like, right? if it gets really long and you're having to go, well, what's this bit doing? And then you're reasoning about that. Well, then pull it into a different function and give it a good name, and then it's really understandable. But there's no hard and fast rules. But don't over factorize, right? Don't have functions that are 2 lines long. What, you know?
Yeah, we're just sharing our aesthetic thoughts on Python code.
But it's more about what theme you use in your editor.
Oh, it's Carlton. It's what font you use. Are you using operator mono? Or are you using,
what's the difference?
Shout out triplicate font. If you know triplicate font, I give you props. That's what I use.
I haven't heard of this one. I'm going to go check it out though. I use Fira code.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, how condescending can I be? Sorry. When I get tired, I just,
my font's better than
your ability goes out. No. Yeah. People, check out triplicate. It's dope. Sorry. What were you going to say though, Dane?
I was going to say, to Carlton's point about factorization, I think it's another case of, like, if you use separation of concerns for every single thing you can think of, you do end up at this like litter box of one line functions or something, right?
Right.
So you kind of have to define what a concern really is. And often the granularity of concerns changes depending on, you know, where you are in the stack, right? Like, granularity of a Django view, concerns in a Django view are going to be probably a slightly different size than if you were, you know, building a real-time millisecond response time API endpoint or something.
Yeah.
I guess those have some overlap, right? But
right. Well, there's some things that are, if it's like too perfect, it's sort of, I wonder if that's the best use of time. Mm-hmm. Like you can, over-factorize them. These things, whereas I would say like test coverage basically can't do enough of that.
But I got this rule of thumb, which is it's only a rule of thumb, but for over 20 years I've kind of come to it, is if I've got like 4 or 5 files open in the editor and I'm having to jump between them and go back and forth to kind of like, oh, what's this? Oh, I've got to go and look in that file, and then I go back to where I was. Okay. Oh, what was this? And I'm in off another file. At that point I'm like, no, this is bad code. Like,
because I should. Okay, nice encapsulation. It's in one file and I use it from another, but I don't have to go and jump and look at the implementation the whole time. And that's where it becomes too much like hard work. It's like you're sweating a brow just to understand the code.
Yeah, and that gets to this idea of cohesion, right? You want things that are working together often to be in the same space.
Yeah, exactly. Cohesion. I knew there was a word for it.
Well, if we're talking favorite programming quotes, I have to say my two favorite, and actually I look back, I have a blog post on this, so
see,
if anyone wondered about my like inner snob, it's totally an outer snob. But my two favorites, one is by Linus Torvalds: if you need more than three levels of indentation, you're screwed anyway and you should fix your program. It's a very Linus hard love approach. But the one I really like is by Ryan Dahl, who created Node.js, who said, the only thing that matters in software is the experience of the user. And he has a whole blog post on this because, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the tooling, but at the end of the day, whether the user is the developer or the, you know, website, it's the, yeah, sometimes you lose track of that. But I do take that to be true.
Mm-hmm. Especially,
I have a whole post on this, Carlton. I'll share it with you. There's like eight quotes in there. So
I'm now trying to pull my favorites out of the archive. Like, let's see.
You don't have a blog post on this?
No, I've got a blog with nothing on. Like, that's what I've got. I don't blog. Like, I try.
Okay, I'll read you
one
more.
No, I'm going to tell you my quote. I've remembered it. I can't remember who it's by, but it goes like this. It goes,
I want you to listen, not tell me.
No, I'm talking now. Go on, you talk.
Again, from Linus: bad programmers worry about their code. Good programmers worry about data structures and their relationships.
Yeah, it's another one like, it's a similar one like that about show me the data structures and I'll understand it. Show me your methods, yeah, and I'll be wondering forever. I can't remember.
But what were you going to say, Carlton?
The one I like is you can engineer code so there are obviously no errors or no obvious errors.
Yeah.
I like that one too.
These deep truths.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see the personality of the, you know, person in them too.
Yeah,
there's different ways to come at the same idea. Well, so we're wrapping up on time here. I know that we have links, we'll put in the show notes, Pod Django 20, that listeners get 40% off the books, which is a pretty nice discount, so they should use that. We'll link to your book. What else would you like to mention? Is there a way people should get in contact with you? What do you have? Are you working on a second book?
I'm not working on a second book at the moment. I've taken a little bit of a break, but maybe someday soon. I'm easy as Python on Twitter. That's probably the sort of best entry point to get in touch with me. I made a website for the book recently called thepythonpro.com, which will also be in the show notes, I imagine. And that's probably it. I would say we'll do one of those two things.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. As I mentioned, I really enjoyed your book. I think it's one of the best out there on Python.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
glad I really you wrote appreciate
it.
That.
I hope people read it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Carlton, anything you want to add?
No. Just thanks for coming on, Dane. Super, really good, interesting chat. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye, everyone.
See you next time.
Bye.